What's on your schedule today?
Been working on the street epistemology course. Did a meeting with some people about that today so far. It's all about what street epistemology is, why to use it, and then how to do it. And it's got like 20 modules we're planning to do. And we've written about 90% of the first 7 modules.
What got you to do that? Were you just walking down the street one day and you're like, what's etymology? And you start chewing on the...
Yeah, and epistemology, yeah. Yeah, I've been very interested in these things ever since. You know, I've been interested in the atheism movement at first, the new atheism movement back in 2011 or so. And then Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, came out in 2013, which coined the phrase street epistemology. But it has evolved considerably since then, yeah.
And why atheism, or new atheism specifically? Were you, you liked the way that they were owning the Christians or something like that?
Yeah. I went to film school in Orlando, and the last year I was there, I attempted to make a movie, a feature film with some friends, and we shot maybe 80% of it over a summer. And I started editing that movie, which I eventually finished, but over the editing of it, those first year or so, it had a lot of themes and ideas that related to religion that just forced me to consider, because I was editing it myself. And at that time, I was also just on this new thing called reddit.com. And at that time, you know, the atheism subreddit was a default subreddit.
You know, which really improved its quality of argument.
Yeah, so I was exposed to all of that, and that made me go down a rabbit hole, like seeing a bunch of YouTube content around atheism, and that's how it started.
So 2013, a lot has happened since 2013, probably in your life, but also in society at large. And how is your view on atheism or new atheism developed? Or do you kind of have like a narrative understanding of how that movement morphed and changed and developed over time?
Yeah, it definitely has changed. And it changed a lot due to James Lindsay, actually. In 2015, I read his new book at the time, Everybody Is Wrong About God. And I did like an online book club where I met him online for the first time, early 2016. And in summer of 2016, I invited him to give a talk called Ending Atheism to my atheist club in Los Angeles. That was very interesting. And he convinced me that basically, you know, we should end atheism, pretty much, like the movement around it. And that we shouldn't really think in terms of what religion is trying to do for people in the terms of theism or atheism, the response to theism. There are better ways to make sense of all that. Yeah.
Is there a recording of that?
There is, yeah.
Is it on your channel? It must be really interesting to have.
It's on the Atheist United YouTube channel. I think the title is like, "There is no God but God," in quotes. And it's funny seeing James Lindsay talk about this stuff that's not, you know, about all the woke stuff. That was like maybe his first online video that I produced for him. Yeah, that was fun. Good talk.
I bet there's some Lindsay completionists out there that would like to have that in their catalog. So you've been working with James, and then you also know Peter for quite some time.
Yeah, then I met up with Peter maybe 2018 or so. A friend of mine wrote a song called "The Adult Table," it's like a cheesy kind of rap song that uses a chapter from a concept from it about the adult table. You know how, we can get into that. But I flew up to Portland and with my friend, and we shot a music video in his garage or attic or somewhere, and you can find that on there on the online somewhere. I won't probably won't give you the link. It's pretty funny. And then, yeah, since then I've been involved with Pete in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been creative this whole time, but mostly through film and like what, script writing? Before you began on the Street Epistemology project, what was your trajectory with regards to creativity?
Yeah, I finally finished that movie in 2017 that I started back in like 2011 or so. That was a big part of my creativity. And in the meantime, I moved to Los Angeles and helped out on other friends' projects in the meantime. And then I started my own YouTube channel in 2016. And that's been the main source of my creativity. So, yeah, since.
Did you know what you were getting into when you started up this YouTube channel?
No, I was really trying to copy this other street epistemologist, Anthony Magnamosco, at first. Basically, yeah, directly copying what he was doing. But he was doing like a stand-up version of street epistemology where he would go out to college campuses or a trail at a park and try to interview people, random strangers. And I did that for a while on my channel. I still do that. I still go out to, right now, UCLA once a week or so to just chat with random people who want to sit down and practice SE. And that's fun. So that's what I've been doing for a while, and yeah, it's still a lot of fun.
How does one practice SE? That sounds a little culty.
It does.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. There's different ways to do it. It's rare to actually go out with a camera in public somewhere and actually do it physically on the street, or you know, in a park or university. Like the street is not really about the physical location. It's about really non-academic ways of collectively trying to make sense. And you can do it with friends and family. You can kind of, it can be a reactive thing. Someone can say something and then you can kind of go into this Socratic method style of conversation that is more focused on, you know, the person's beliefs and their reasons for it. And how we could know their reasons are good reasons, kind of reasoning about our reasoning. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I do it in public, I try to let people come up and pick a topic, anything they want to talk about. And I try to keep my views out of it. I explain my goals and give them a heads up about what I'm going to be doing. And yeah, let them just give reasons for their beliefs. I guide them through questions, through that Socratic method style.
So if you leave your beliefs out of it, you're not leaving your reasoning out of it, and nor your experience and your memory and then your practice and the habit that you've gotten into with this. So what are beliefs then that you can just remove from your mind while you're doing this? Is there like, what are beliefs?
Yeah, I do have certain values and expectations for what constitutes a good reason and a good argument. So I am kind of questioning that from my implicit questioning's perspective. That's part of it. But if they ask me what my particular level of confidence is for the claim we're talking about, that I try to not make clear unless they ask. But I am implicitly, you know, connecting some of my beliefs and values with when I'm talking to someone. So it is about rationality and logic and reason and all of that that goes into it. But I'm also open to being wrong about all of that, potentially, if people have other ways of thinking about things that make sense more broadly.
You said the term non-academic. So there's still reason and logic and argument and evaluation of those things. What makes it non-academic, like in your mind? Is that kind of an aesthetic?
Yeah, we try to use the language and words of the person we're talking to, and we try to keep it casual, and we're not introducing jargon from academia about epistemology or sense making or rationality, like using Bayesian or words like that, or falsifiability. We're were using these academic concepts, but in like plain language, you know, regular language ways.
But have you ever gotten into a place where you're in the middle of an SE practice and somebody just hauls out and punches you in the nose for asking too many questions? Does it ever get dangerous or heated, at least?
Very rarely. I've never had a physical altercation. But very, very rarely it even comes to like raised voices or anything. Most of the time people are very happy to have had the chat. And it's really nice.
I guess that's up to you. Is it just you and your interlocutor? Or is it you fielding a discussion with two other people?
Yeah, there's different ways, I guess, as it can be used. It can be used one-on-one. It can be used just by yourself, you thinking about something. Or, with one SE person and at most maybe three other interlocutors, to do like the classic SE style. And then more than three, it gets complicated. You'd have to do, we have this SE survey, which is a little different, but it's still reasoning about our reasoning in other ways. So it's more broad, more meta when you get more than three.
Hmm. You brought up Socratic method. Is that doesn't count as academic jargon?
It is academic jargon, I guess, but I do also explain that it is a kind of Socratic method style. I guess I am expecting people to know what that is. Maybe I should.
I just like to clarify what that is, because maybe I'm doing it, maybe I'm not, maybe you're doing it, maybe you're not. When do I know that I'm doing it? When do I know that I'm not doing it? What is the Socratic method?
Yep. Boghossian explains it in his way in the first book with like five steps, I think. It's like you wonder about something, a question with someone, and they give you an answer, like a hypothesis for that question. And then you go through the Alingus, this Q&A thing where you're trying to rebut with questions, either with like, hypothetical probing questions to reveal potential contradictions in the answer. And then if you find a contradiction, then you go to the next step, which is to revise the hypothesis, and you repeat that from like steps two to four a couple of times until you have something that sticks, and then you act accordingly, the fifth step.
Oh, you have to put it into practice?
That's just the last step, yeah.
Develop a policy or vote accordingly or something like that?
Yeah, you're just expected to go with the answer that you come up with.
And as over the course of you doing this and interviewing people kind of randomly on a pickup, have you noticed a pattern in what people are concerned about? I know that it's a... What's it called? You have a very limited sample because you are on a college campus. So maybe you have kind of a sense of what college folk are thinking about and willing to talk about. Do you?
Yeah. I do go to a local park sometimes and the college campus, and those, like I go to West Hollywood Park, the Runyon Canyon Park, and those are all about woo stuff like astrology and law of attraction, and that's a lot that's happening there. On campus at UCLA, it's a lot of politics, a lot of social issues. I also have like a little board next to my table with a few potential claims to talk about or broad questions, and I'm trying to focus a little bit on wokeness and all of that right now. So maybe that's just a bias in the selection process of people who I'm getting and talking to. Yeah.
Is there a law of attraction between you and wokeness going on there?
A little bit, yeah. It is something I really care about.
Why?
It's anti-science and unethical, and which I don't like.
I could see how it's anti-science. We can explore that claim, but what do you mean by it's unethical? That seems really interesting. What makes it unethical?
the group guilt part of it.
Okay.
And the anti-liberal values part of it. Classic so, American values.
So on that first part, the group guilt would be all white people are racist, and I'm just, this is a claim that you hear, black people can't be racist. And so there's this one way assignation of guilt, blame, and then a proposition on acting according to that. And yeah. Does that bother you? Why does that bother you? Why is that counter ethical to you, group guilt? Do you understand why people are attracted to that and why you reject that?
Yeah. I don't see it as a good way of thinking about justice and getting to where we want to be in terms of a better world. It kind of relates to this other concept of liberal science, which is this way of managing conflict. That comes from kind of the Inquisitor Jonathan Rowse's first book. And I think that's, you know, both wokeness is both anti-liberal and anti-science. So it's against that main thing from that book. And that book is about the morality of that conflict resolution system. It is, he gives a moral argument for it in the book. And I agree with that moral argument. And wokeness is against liberalism and science and liberal science.
So have you spoken with someone who ascribes to this woke ideology and been able to question the assumptions that underline the claims? Because it seems like there's not a lot of questioning, or they do a lot, at least the institutions do a lot to preclude questionings of the claims. So have you been able to work on that individually and drill down into that and see how it's operating?
Yeah, I still have not had the conversation I want to have with someone who is as woke as I'd like to have someone be when I talk to them. Like, I really want to test out street epistemology if it can be used with the woke. Like, I know it can, it's great for virtually any other kind of ideology or belief, but the woke ideology, it's super hard. I did talk with someone, I think 2 weeks ago. We talked about in like revolution or reform, and she was very woke. She wanted revolution. She was like she was mentioning stuff like the pedagogy of the oppressed and a bunch of other books like that. Like she mentioned she read The New Jim Crow in a community college, and that inspired her to go to UCLA and learn more about this stuff. And we got pretty deep, but not as deep as I wanted to. I still want to, still requires more testing. Anthony Magnabosco talked with someone a couple of years ago, and then I did a reaction video with James Lindsay. Did you see that one, that first reaction video?
Very recent one, or is this a prior?
The prior one that did that. Yeah, I did a reaction video with James about those two conversations Anthony talked with someone who's very woke. And that got pretty deep. So I think that's the best example so far of an essay conversation with someone who's woke.
What causes, this more general question, what causes something to become more deep within street epistemology? How do you know you're getting deep?
Yeah, there's like the belief in the epistemology level, and then the feelings level, and then the identity and psychosocial motivations level. It can go that deep. And once you hit identity and those psychosocial motivations, that's pretty deep. You talk about stuff like meaning and morality and all of that. And that's all very deep.
It sounds like when you use the term identity, you don't mean in the intersectional way.
No, like your personal...
Individual
self and identity, like how it fits in with your community and social. It's like the sociality part of it. That's another framing that I get from Everybody's Wrong About God, James Lindsay's book. It's about these three main things, the main categories of psychosocial motivations, two psychological, one social. This psychological one is control, two is sense making or ways of making sense of the world, and the third is the social one, that just the general sociality category of kind of a psychological or social motivation. Like, that's what he claims God is doing for people, helping people meet these needs.
Okay. Or God. Mm-hmm. God.
The concept of God in theism.
Well, I was speaking with James Lindsay just this past weekend, and he's a good friend of mine at this point, and I'm watching him develop over time, or his arguments and his investigations just lead him from one thing to the next. And he began to use theology as a term, and I had not heard him use that. And he brought up a writer. I have all my notes here, but I'm not going to slow down or talk.
Neumann or something?
Is it Neumann? He was talking about, this author was talking about the university and how there's a theological component, that if the university doesn't have a theological component, which would organize epistemology, ontology, axiology, which is about values, and sociology, then that will eventually be filled by something else. And usually, probably by people without the tools to do that work, to build this theology. So that kind of runs into a street level critique of the woke as being a new religion. And coming from a new atheist background and then going through a number of different changes, I suppose, what is the quality of a theology or a system of belief that is necessary for social cohesion and for and to replace or to mitigate the anti-liberal, anti-science bent of this woke stuff? What is your conception of a need for theology or a need for some sort of God consciousness for us to get out of this quagmire?
That's the question of our age at this point. How do we get this, what some people call a religion that's not a religion, but it is that robust science of meaning that James says, like, what of theology, that connection of epistemology, ontology, and axiology. At this point, the best I've got is that argument of the naturalist nuke from King Crocoduck's video. Like, that's a good starting point for how potentially epistemology, axiology, and ontology are all related. It's like he grounds science as a natural value category. It's like it's a category that a value that nature produced, not society. That's the thing that is very interesting to me. And if we had that, we could ground a lot of stuff on that and then build on that potentially. But that's over my pay grade. I have no idea.
Wait, you're getting paid for this? Don't answer that. Natural value, though, doesn't that run against this? And this might be the problem I have with people using fallacies, is that they're kind of basically, there's a fallacy where people just say, oh, that's a whataboutism, or that's a sea lioning, or that's a slippery slope, or that's a natural fallacy. We just say, oh, we just don't do that. They become axioms rather than bad reasoning. So it might be worth kind of impacting, and this would probably be on my pay grade too, the natural fallacy and how you would get from derive an ought from an is, and how science would be that derivation process, perhaps.
Yeah, in the video he says he's not doing that.
They always say
I'm
that.
Not sure, and I'm not sure. It's like we're not claiming the values are potentially good. It's just we're just saying they're natural values. And what he's talking about is this way of developing a model that is scientific. science, it is, science is really an evolved cognitive process that all life uses to pragmatically exist in reality. And there's like, we can get into that, but that's what that's about. And he does say it's like not exactly deriving a nod from it is, but you'd have to talk with him to more about that potentially.
I've spoken with Brett Weinstein quite a bit. He's an evolutionary biologist, as I'm sure you are aware. And I did a lot of interviews with him around evolutionary biology and trying to grapple with that understanding of the world just as an assumption of something more coming from something less, or life coming from that which isn't life, just by some sort of random process. And you kind of get a sense after listening to it for a while, I've gotten a sense that basically evolutionary theory is describing an editing process within the realm of existing in time and being mortal, or existing within time, meaning that there's entropy happening, and that's kind of a value set. Everything that survives entropy is goes through an evolutionary process, especially as the world's changing, and then adaptation happens, and then also sexual selection happens on top of that, which is kind of a prediction tool, sexual selection being a prediction tool of one of the mates or both of the mates deciding, this is a bet that I'm going to make because it's probably going to pay out. And you said that science is a cognitive or a high cognitive process, but it's basically blind until you get some sort of conscious being or pseudo-conscious being.
Yeah, an evolved cognitive process, and even slime molds do it. That's another part of the video that King Crocoduck showed. It's like they can create models of the world and act in it and solve problems in a very proto way, but
okay.
Yeah.
So the science being the creation of a model of the world and then conforming one's behavior to that model of the world to exploit it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's differences in quality of these models. And he gives the big four operational criteria, he says, is like how you judge the quality of this model. Four criteria, yeah. The first one is applicability. Its ability to predict stuff in the world accurately and precisely. The second category is efficiency, how well the model works by itself individually and how well it works with other models. That's like parsimony and consilience. And the third is accountability, how well it works with new evidence coming in. It shouldn't be too flexible or too rigid. It wants to be just right. We'll get into that. And then the internal consistency of the model, the rational coherence. Like it can't be contradictory with itself. All of those big four things are how you judge the quality of a scientific model, he says. And slime molds do this. And so, and like all of life does this. And it's very interesting.
I would say that wokeness, insofar as it's a ideology that has been created through a process of selection in the academy and within the Western world, and then within your post-Enlightenment thinkers, if you trace back where it came from, it's still an evolved thing. And the way that it's spreading probably is operating scientifically, but the field of reality that it's operating in is not the individual level, not the reality level, but the institutional level. The institution environment is exploiting. And if we look at it that way, we can see it as kind of impersonal, but also at the same time personal thing that's operating.
Yeah, there's just like this parasite leeching onto the core thing of science. Scientific institutions are not itself science, which may be in conflict with what Jonathan Rauch has in his new book. Like King Crocoduck says, there is a core of science, and that's the development and testing of these models. And then there's an institution wrapped around that, and all of that that's related to that. So, yeah.
And there's a feedback loop there because you can't really have science being tested adequately without some sort of infrastructure to test it. But insofar as science is able to provide some sort of success, more institution grows around science.
Yeah. You can get higher quality models with better infrastructure and administration, but we can still do science ourselves individually and collectively outside of academia.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, if you look at the kind of the forerunners of the modern day Enlightenment, a lot of those men were basically independently wealthy in one way or another. There wasn't a lot, or the extent of the institutional infrastructure for science wasn't there. But once science, the Industrial Revolution, the byproducts of science came into play, and then all the wars and just the changes in society, then you have this institution. If we just look at the United States of America, just the sprawling, kind of decentralized institution with pockets of centralization within, I guess, departments or some form of, I guess, back in the day before they were compromised, those journals were kind of centralization of the knowledge that was kind of decentralized in all these different individual universities. And if we look at how wokeness advanced through the institution, you can see that it started outside of science itself. Or what do you think about that?
Like scientific journals is one place our knowledge can live, and that can be corrupted through idea laundering, as Brett says, mm-hmm. which I think has happened, which is a tragedy. It's killing the legitimacy of the university system at this point, allowing all that idea laundering to happen. Like, we want to be able to trust them. But yeah, we can have knowledge live in books outside of peer review, in just the popular culture, potentially, where people just, it's memes. It's like the meme level. It's just out there.
But at some point, it has to be organized in order to create an effect. And if wokeness itself is glomming onto the organizational structure, and I think eventually it'll meet up with reality, and hopefully humans, the human reality, will stop it before it crashes into reality itself. But it's glomming onto the infrastructure, and like you're saying with idea laundering, I see this in a lot of different areas, not just within journals. And I guess we should define idea laundering. It's the product of using the authority that was accumulated by the institution, and then populating it by people that have the titles, of doctor or of expert, then start to promote certain ideas over time, and then just share those ideas over time without ever actually having to test those ideas. Like, there's this breakdown of actually testing the ideas. There's a breakdown in the accountability aspect of knowledge creation.
Yeah, like the usual way you do peer review is what Wokel said in one of your videos before. It's like you set aside your biases and then make objective judgments. Like, you make objective tests, have these high quality models, and test them with as much bias mitigated as possible. That gives you scientific credibility. But this, the idea laundering is like, they're kind of separate journals all incestuously together, and they just make assertions and cite each other, and it's just assertion built on assertion, and nothing objective coming into it at all that people could check in the real world. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so ultimately the net byproduct of all of those ideas that haven't been checked in the real world will have to be checked at some point. So either we can speed it along and go nuclear, like, I don't know if King Kokedek's saying we should go nuclear. James has said we go nuclear. Peter Boghossian said we should just go nuclear. What do you think about that?
I don't know. It would be sad if everything went nuclear in that way, which is just the institution is just falling. And I don't know how that would happen. Like, you would have 95% of them potentially fall, and like the few with the big endowments survive. But parallel institutions, that's going to take a long time. Mm. What are we going to do in the meantime? I don't know. This is hard.
Yeah. Well, if what they're producing is mostly crap, then isn't there like a net benefit for them not being around? And by that, I mean, a lot of the humanities departments, just these reams and reams and reams of papers on critical theory and revolution and all that stuff. There's only so many gender study papers that need to be produced. There are only so many, and there are only so many bodies that can be medically altered to conform to these gender beliefs. So we don't need them replicated in every city, every state, right?
True.
But if they're going to take, but I guess the counterbalance is that if they're going to take down science with them, if they're going to take down all their research institutes and all the research happening with them, which is probably likely what will happen.
Yeah, we need that stuff. That's need that for sure. And so we need to like audit these universities. That's one project that Peter Boghossian is going to be doing next spring that I'm going to be helping him with, like a university reverse Q&A tour. Have you seen that? His video on that yet?
No, not yet.
Yeah, he's going to be just next spring going on a tour of like 10 to 15 universities and inviting people to like students to speak, and he'll be in the audience and ask them questions to try to help them think about stuff and just get a sense of where they are in terms of how much social justice is in their classes. Like, is it causing a problem? And just letting them speak and hearing what's happening in the universities.
Hmm.
Yeah.
From the ground up, from the students rather than the admin or the faculty.
Yeah.
Who have a vested interest of varying sorts to keep certain things under wraps, I'm sure. Not least of all liability if the lawyers are there, and they will be there, because this stuff will probably be recorded if you're involved.
Oh, it'll be recorded and posted very shortly on YouTube, all of it. We're going to try to record a lot of stuff. It's going to be fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're doing all this thinking, and you're doing all this working with these high-profile individuals. What do you... Do you have like a repository of your understanding outside of the interview? Do you have some sort of writing that you're doing, or how do you concretize your understanding of where you are in the world as you're doing all this?
Yeah, I do have kind of second brain type system. I'm very also a productivity nerd. I have like an Evernote where I take all this stuff that I find and stick it in there, although I need to review it more. I do have this other way of categorizing arguments in this website, kialo.com, and I can kind of organize the arguments and claims for claims, reasons for reasons within that site. That's one way that's helping me for sure. And I did a video on with Hill and Pluckrose 2 years ago, I think, and we talked about the broad question: what's the best way to help make the world a better place? What are the best ideas and values to do it? And we had a bunch of answers like liberalism and critical social justice, conservatism. Yeah, all of those answers were there, and that's like my map of that. And it's huge by now. It's really big.
Mm-hmm. Is it like do you have a model, or is it 3D printed somewhere? You sell it for Christmas swag?
No. It's just my own thing. I have. I'm always adding stuff to it.
Is there are you ever tempted to have a belief system? I'm a classical liberal. I am a post-Christian. I'm a neophyte of L. Ron Hubbard or anything like that.
It's hard. I do think I think of myself as a liberal, as a humanist, liberal humanist, I guess. And, you know, that's as far as I go at this point. I do want to keep my identity small. There's a lot of bias that comes in if you have too big of an identity or adding, glomming on too much to it, potentially.
Hmm.
It's hard to have it be questioned if it's part of your identity, stuff like that.
That's a difficult balance to explain to people who rely on labels to categorize people. You know, I had a live stream with Adam Friended, and he wanted me to say that I was a centrist or not. And I couldn't, I can't assign myself a label without feeling a loss of flexibility. But I know that that comes at a price of not necessarily confidence, but maybe something like that. It's hard to do anything with any amount of leverage if you don't have something to stand on. And so I have to choose my battles carefully, or how I engage carefully, because I don't want to be forced into a position where I have to cement something like a label. But then I know that that makes me sound pretty fishy, and kind of like a sneaky fucker, as a technical term.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of like that cost benefit analysis on that level.
Mm-hmm. There's disadvantages and advantages to having a public identity associated with stuff like that. Like, it allows you to fit in better, easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we're part of this like tribe of non-tribes, I guess. It's the skeptical part of tribe.
Huh, yeah. Does that, I guess that makes, this skeptical tribe is inherently weak. It's like herding cats in a way. And I see that the role that we have is kind of a servant to other tribes, or a servant to individuals within tribes, where we are, there's probably some sort of biological metaphor about some sort of thing that transports nutrients between other things, right? There's some sort of, we can affect a causeway. The centrist is that which is run over. It stands in the middle of the road so long that it becomes the road itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where being run over is part of our identity, maybe, or function rather than identity.
Yeah, there's this one white paper that I love that came about a few years ago called The Mimetic Tribes and the Culture War 2.0.
Yeah, yeah.
And Street Epistemology Tribe is one of the mimetic tribes. And they have one concept of called like the mimetic mediator is one thing someone could do. And that's something I've been thinking about with SE. I think that would be a perfect fit for SE.
Does that work on the level of the meme, like the meme, like the crude meme?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The Pepe, you can get Pepe to speak to a Hillary Clinton supporter.
Potentially. That would be great. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Kekistan and Bernie bros kind of start to get along a little bit. But the problem, one of the diagnostic problems with wokeness, or what we call wokeness, is its resilience or its avoidance of mediation, of being mediated.
Yeah, of conversation in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. It's like they all have interaction, but it's mainly combative. And you know, you're just insulted and said you're a bad name or something. That's mm-hmm. how it usually goes. So, but there are people on the border of woke that are more able to be talked to.
Do you think that it's actually not as big of a problem, or it's highly overrepresented because of how it represents itself as purely combative? Maybe that's hiding just how little credence it actually has.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So potentially we'd have to figure that out. We'd have to establish a test.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hard to say. Yeah. But I'm just going out there to the university and seeing who will talk to me within it, if they're in deep or on the edge. Either one, I'm interested.
And Have you seen people move from on the edge or outside of it into it? Have you seen the transit into becoming woke? I guess you hinted at that with that one woman you spoke to about who read Jim Crow or the new Jim Crow. And do you understand what ideas it there are or it holds up that allow people to become identified with it?
Maybe. There's one distinction that James says. It's like structural determinism. If you accept that, then you're down the road of woke. But if you reject that, then you're not, which is the systemic nature of these ideologies they claim. Like, if you accept we are socialized into political positions due to forces outside of our control, and that implies we should do certain things in the world, that's an interesting criteria. The more you buy into that, the harder it is to probably have a conversation.
To mix in Jonathan Haidt, there might be a not just so much a moral predilection or a psychological predilection, but an intellectual predilection to perceive oneself as the product more rather than less of social determinants. And then that would be why you would end up saying that you start believing in that. There might be some sort of circumstance prior to that belief that gets people to believe that. And academics there might be some sort of midwittery going on where either resentment or they're not getting enough, or they were promised one thing and they see that they're kind of second-rate citizens and they think more highly of themselves. Also, you see kind of in feminism and other, not feminism as a whole, but within the activist side of it and other groups that glom onto a victimhood mentality. There's certain circumstances that make them feel like a victim, and then that becomes their identity. And then once you have victim status, then you have to believe in social determinism, because I don't even think it's social determinism so much as the locus of control is outside of you. Once that is there, then you're probably going to believe in some sort of determinism. You have to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about where your determinism is located.
And it's more than mere social determinism, but like the structural determinism, which means social constructivism or critical constructivism, is the woke core ideology. Like the critical constructivism, it's that fusion of the critical theory and the postmodernism together. That thing, if you think that stuff determines who people are and how they act and how they think, that's just a recipe for disaster. You know, like, how do we get people who think that way or have that model of the world to shift to a higher quality model?
Why is that a disaster?
For the reasons we discussed before, it creates us versus them type thinking, and it becomes a negative sum game, and that will lead to violence eventually.
Where I started at the Evergreen State College, and I'm back into it now. I kind of finished the documentary that I did on it, which took me a long time, and then I just kind of said I'm done now, but then I had one more thing to do, and now I'm doing that thing, and so I'm going through all the transcripts and trying to organize it in a way that can convey the belief and then the different levels of the different ways that that belief manifests in the different characters, depending on basically their status in the hierarchy. The president of the college, if he believes in this stuff, he has to prostrate himself. And then the lowest people on the college have to force him to prostrate himself. So they can't even allow him to prostrate himself. Every time he does, they have to actually kick him when he's down, because of the way that this entire critical project works, is that the deconstruction of hierarchies is in and of, in itself the right of passage for this thing to operate. And so you can't allow the person on the top to humiliate themselves without also humiliating them even further. There's this complete destruction of everything that goes along. And that, because as I was going through all the footage of that incident, there's so much contradiction constantly going on that it's really difficult to understand it because it's constantly contradicting itself. So you have to figure out how is there like a precursor, some sort of pre-contradictory understanding that they have that allows them to get away with all these contradictions, you know, because they're just dangling over the abyss. And it's just a fascinating thing. And I'm taking all that stuff and I'm transcribing it into music, which is a completely different form. So trying to use music as a mode of communicating this stuff is eventually going to lead me into a cul-de-sac, because I would have to actually like become counter harmonic and disharmonic and cacophonous to really convey the tone and the music of this. It has to contradict on every level. So as we go through that, I'm going to have to just be listening to that.
Wow. Yeah. I don't envy that job. Man, that stuff is so stressful to watch. Yeah. Your documentary, Mike Nana's documentary, and hopefully we'll get a lot more next spring.
You're hoping that some the Glass House will get a few cracks.
It'd be nice to have some drama. It'd be nice to have something.
Yeah.
You know. It's just, if your social status and prestige are tied up in victimhood, you'll get there by any means necessary, contradictory or otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment in your intellectual development where you were imbalanced? And there's two ways that this could go, I'm thinking, but I want you to answer the question. But I was just thinking, you're aware of this victim status. Were you ever tempted to think of yourself as a victim? Or on the other hand, being hyper rational, Was there not like a period in time where you just deconstructed everything in your head and got meta, and then learned how to control that?
Yeah. The New Atheism as a movement went woke in 2011, right when I entered it. Oh. And I picked up a lot of that, you know, ethos of victimhood and oppressor. And yeah, I guess at some point I felt pretty guilty for being who I was, like my class status as well, and all of that. But since then I've gotten past that. Not sure how it worked or how it happened. Not sure.
Was there like a religious community that you were in prior to New Atheism? Did you have a sense of, like, within Christianity, guilt is constellated in a entire equation. In New Atheism, is that when you first discovered that guilt existed? And
no, I grew up Southern Baptist. Okay. So there was some guilt there growing up nominally. And then it waned over time from high school into college. Yeah. By college, I was very apathetic about religion in general.
Okay. And then within New Atheism, and then weighted by that guilt, was that an anti-apathy awakening kind of thing where you had meaning and motivation?
Yeah. It's just that age range of 18 to 22. Yeah. People start trying to figure out who they are and what they should do. And that was just me. You know, I found atheism as a potential important set of problems to help solve. And I think that they had some legitimate problems that they wanted to solve. And I think they virtually solved them at this point. So like just the Christian supremacy type problem in the culture, I think that's gone now. I think we're fine. I think it's not a big deal to be an atheist in society at this point. So,
well, you're either You're either a racist or an anti-racist.
That's the main thing now. So who cares about atheism anymore?
I really don't know. And I think it's a cognitive capacity and also probably some sort of psychological spin. I don't think that society as a whole can be anti-religious or non-religious. There is only certain forms of religion that allow for people who don't need it to interact with people who do, and to allow the people who need it to accept people who don't, and vice versa. I mean, that's the kind of the religion, non-religion thing has to take into account that just on a society level, there's just people that need it and want it too. Mm-hmm. And people who don't.
Yeah. It kind of relates to James's theology thing. Like we all seek meaning, and his like science of meaning thing, which he defines theology as, like, meaning is important to all humans to varying degrees. And religion is one way of meeting that in general, but there are other ways, and some need a lot of it and use religion to do it. But I'd love to have another way that can get to meaning and a kind of meaning that relates all of these things of the epistemology, ontology, and axiology, something really robust. That would be great. Yeah.
Do you have a, do you have a clue, like what kind of meaning you like and how you like it?
Yeah. Stoicism is good. Hmm. I like that philosophy. And just the general, you know, being connected to a community that cares about issues that you care about and having shared projects in that way, and just having, you know, quality relationships, friendships, and all the other relationships, stuff like that. Love, you know, loving relationship, trying to get there for me, but eventually. But right now, friendships, shared projects, shared, you know, that type of thing. That'll do it for me.
Is there a subsidiary way that you interact with people besides talking? Seems like you're a talker. I'm a talker too. That's how I exchange meaning with people. Is there another non-talking activity?
I do poker with friends, but that's kind of just an excuse to talk, I guess. But I do, I still like the game and the dynamics that happen from that. Besides that, I'm not really into sports or anything.
Are you good at poker, you think?
Not really.
No.
I'm okay.
I don't understand the game. I can't keep value stable for that long. I have a hard time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you, why do you like it? What is it about it that's animating?
I don't know. It's just, it's fun to play this, like, intention game. It's like you're trying to, it's also a kind of way to have many games of scientific hypothesis testing. You're building a model of, you know, who has what each round, but you're also building a model of the psychology of everyone on the table. And all of these models fit together in this way that's really intuitive. And people get really good at, you know, predicting what people have, and if they're lying, like, that's, and you're doing predictions, you're putting your money on it. So it's a great way to test how rational you are. It's a very interesting.
So you can, within poker, you can't lie to yourself, but you have to lie to others.
That you can lie to others, potentially. Yeah.
Wait, you don't have to?
And you don't.
Don't, well, you want it?
You probably don't. Probably not going to get very far if you don't do it some part of the time. Yeah.
Huh. Mm. And then also it collapses. Like there's an end state. Like a hypothesis, and then it's there's proof.
Yeah, so there's a result of the test every round, and then of the whole like 3-hour cash game that you're in, who has the most by the end. Mm-hmm. Tell if it was just lucky or if people made wise decisions. It's very interesting.
Yeah, who knows about the relationship between luck and wisdom? I guess wisdom is knowing not to think luck isn't luck, but also appreciating it when it is there. I don't know.
Yeah, luck is definitely a part of it. Yeah, it's just, yeah, you can increase your likelihood of winning with rationality, with wise choices. Yeah.
Huh. And okay, so rationality is a semi-academic term for me, because people, we say that it's like critical theory. We kind of know what it is. We kind of don't know what it is. With logic, we can kind of use a soft form of logic, but there's definitely a hard form of logic. I think that there's softer and harder forms, or intuitive and calculative forms of rationality. Is that fair to say? Like, what is it to be rational?
I guess there's two ways. It's like having epistemic rationality, having accurate models of the world, accurate maps of reality.
Like the card counter kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know that the statistics of, you know, and the odds of getting certain hands and based on what's on the board. And also having a robust model of human psychology. That's also part of it, potentially. That's just part of epistemic rationality. And then instrumental rationality, it's like having good strategies to get to your goals.
Hmm.
Yeah, to meet that. You know, like effective altruism is all about instrumental rationality, getting the most for the least input, most output.
What's effective altruism again?
It's this whole movement from the rationalist community. I think that's where it started. It's like, how do you most effectively make the world a better place? Like with, you know, the money that you have, the resources that you put into it, how do you get the most out of it? So yeah, with street epistemology, I'm mainly focusing on the epistemic rationality and helping people think through beliefs and claims and arguments. It's kind of a self-defense tool as well. When you hear something from someone, it helps you protect yourself from swindlers and, you know, con artists. If you have, you know, good robust background knowledge of a lot of stuff, you can pick up on what people are trying to do, and you can tell if things don't quite make sense, if things are contradictory to other things in your background knowledge. It helps you get a sense of when people are bullshitting you. Like, you don't want to be bullshitted. And yeah, if you have a problem that needs to be solved, you can apply rationality to help you solve it. Hmm. Think through it. It's really great.
Do you have a, I guess you're going to be working with Peter come this spring. What's that called again, that project again?
The Reverse Q&A Tour.
Oh. Okay. So Peter's not the one who's AMAing. He's the one who's
A-ing.
U-ing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
And I would like to, I need a 3-person camera crew.
Oh, okay.
I have one person that I think is going to join me, but I need one more. And I would love to like invite you to join if you were interested. Like that would be great. I think
do a mini really tour in the spring. Okay.
You are definitely invited.
Okay. We'll look at the calendar for that then off camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you have a, like a magnum opus that teases you every once in a while? Do you have a sense that in the future, in your 50s, at some point you're going to do a thing? Is there something on the horizon that you think is ahead of you?
Vague notions. Like, I'd love to do another feature film on something, you know, fiction, but that's a while off. I'd love to get to do that again. That's fun. Yeah. No idea what it would be, though.
Yeah. Do you ever see things in the culture, cultural artifacts that are particularly effective at doing what you would like to be done which would be dispelling the woke chokehold? Can art do that without becoming just propaganda?
It can make a case for an answer to a broad question, like leaving it open for people to either accept the case or not, or it can just ask the question and present a scenario where the question is obviously the thing that's being asked and not give a definitive answer. It can be a vague type thing, or it can be propaganda. And it's like, yes, this is the answer that you should believe. I think that's where it gets into propaganda, but real, you know, true film is not propaganda. It's something more than that. You want it to be truth and beauty, like true and beautiful, that type of thing, where it's not propaganda. It's like you can feel when it's going to go too far, but that's something I tried to think about.
Have you, has there been a film this year that's blown your socks off? Or when's the last time a film really blew your socks off?
I watched the Get Back documentary series last week. That was really great.
The Beatles.
That was just amazing. I don't know how they restored the audio on that and got the video. Like, I'd love to see the before and after of how they did that. But like fiction films, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Hard to say. I'll have to look up my letterbox.
I really liked Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It was probably the last one that I watched over and over again. For some reason, I just really liked that film.
Yeah, that's great.
Dune wasn't bad. I'll say that about Dune. The sound design was excellent.
Yeah, Dune. I like Dune. Mm-hmm.
Villa Venue is pretty cool.
Yeah. The French Dispatch was okay. That's pretty funny.
When was that?
A couple months ago. That's Wes Anderson's latest movie.
Oh, okay.
Pig with Nicolas Cage. That was actually really good.
Wait, P-I-G?
P-I-G with Nicolas Cage.
Shit.
That was actually...
When was that? When did that come out?
That was a random independent movie this summer.
I think I saw the poster online for it or something.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
Was it what's the rating? Like, it was super violent, super perverse, or...
Not really, no. It was very low-key and just a character piece. It was like just a tragedy unfolding, and I loved it.
I'll check it out then. I just don't want to be upset.
Yeah. Oh, Bo Burnham's Inside. I love that. But that's more a comedy show.
Oh, that's a show.
The comedy special that Bo Burnham made inside his like external garage over the pandemic last year. Love that. Yeah. Good stuff though.
Well, Reed, I'm going to end the recording now. Thank you for joining me and doing a little bit of kind of like a walkie talkie epistemology kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love the conversations.
You brought the calm, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.